blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, as part of a series, 5 years later, more from COVID-19, this article is entitled, America is Sleeping on a Powerful Defense Against Airborne Disease. And this was written by Roxanne Camsey. It is the early evening of March 7th, 2020. I was on my cell phone in an airport terminal telling a friend that I was afraid to write an article that risked ruining my journalistic reputation. I had been speaking with the small but close-knit aerobiologist community about the possibility that the new coronavirus could travel easily from person to person through the air, not just through large droplets that reach only a short distance from an infected person or through handshakes. The scientists had stressed that the idea of airborne transmission of the new virus was still mostly theoretical, but they'd seemed pretty concerned. When my story came out the following week, it was, to my knowledge, the first article by a journalist to make the case that the virus causing COVID-19 might travel efficiently through the air and could potentially cover many meters in a gaseous cloud emitted with a cough or a sneeze. To avoid stoking undue worry, I had argued against calling the virus airborne in the headline, which ran as, quote, they say coronavirus isn't airborne, but it's definitely borne by air, end quote. That idea was not immediately accepted. 2 weeks later, the World Health Organization tweeted, fact, at COVID-19 is not airborne. As the pandemic unfolded, though, it became clear that the coronavirus did indeed spread through airborne transmission, even if the World Health Organization took more than a year and a half to officially describe the coronavirus as a long-range airborne pathogen. By then, amid the loud debate over mask mandates, vaccine boosters, and individuals' responsibility for the health of others, a parallel debate had emerged over ventilation. Wearing an N95 or receiving a third COVID shot were ultimately individual choices, but breathing safer air in indoor spaces required buy-in from bigger players, such as education departments and transit agencies. Some advocates held up clean air as a kind of public good, one worth investing in for shared safety. If it had succeeded, this way of thinking would have represented one of the most lasting paths for governments to decrease people's risks from COVID and from airborne diseases more generally. In the United States, the federal government regulates the quality of air outdoors, but it has relatively little oversight of indoor air. State and local jurisdictions pick up some of the slack, but this creates a patchwork of rules about indoor air. Local investment in better air quality infrastructure varies widely, too. For example, a 2022 survey of COVID ventilation measures in U.S. public school districts found that only about a quarter of them used or planned to use HEPA HEPA filters, which have a dense mesh for trapping particles for indoor air. An even smaller fraction, about 8%, had installed air cleaning systems that incorporated ultraviolet light, which can kill germs. For decades, experts have pushed the idea that the government should pay more attention to the quality of indoor air. In his new book, Airborne, The Hidden History of the Life We Breathe, the journalist Carl Zimmer shows the long arc of this argument. He notes that Richard Riley, a giant in the field of aerobiology, who helped show that tuberculosis can be airborne, believed that individuals shouldn't have to ensure that the air they breathe is clean. Just as the government regulates the safety of the water that flows into indoor pipes, it should oversee the safety of air in all indoor public spaces. More than a half a century before the coronavirus pandemic, Riley positioned this idea as an alternative to requirements for widespread masking, which he said call for a kind of benevolent despotism, Zimmer reports. If cleaner air was the one of the best ways to reduce the societal burden of disease, then the two best ways to achieve it were to push people to wear masks in any public space or to install better ventilation. The latter approach, purifying the air, would mean that the individual would be relieved of direct responsibility. Excuse me, Riley reasoned in a 1961 book he co-authored. This is preventative medicine at its best, but it can only be bought at the price of civic responsibility and vigilance. Medical breakthroughs in the years that followed may have deflated enthusiasm for this idea. Zimmer writes that the huge advances in vaccines during the 1960s made the world less interested in the details of airborne disease transmission. Thanks to new vaccines, doctors had a way to prevent measles. The World Health Organization launched a campaign to eradicate smallpox, and polio seemed to be on its way out. On top of that, researchers had come up with an arsenal of life-saving antibiotics and antivirals. How viruses reached us mattered less when our defenses against them were so strong. In the first year or so of the coronavirus pandemic, though, one of the only defenses against COVID was avoiding it. And as a debate raged over how well the virus spread in air, the science of aerobiology was thrust into the spotlight. Some members of the public started fighting for good ventilation. A grassroots effort emerged to put homemade air purifiers and portable HEPA filters in public places. Teachers opened classroom windows when they learned that their schools lacked proper ventilation. Travelers started carrying carbon dioxide monitors to gauge the air quality aboard planes. And restaurants began offering outdoor dining after diagrams were published showing how easily one person eating inside can expose those seated nearby to the virus. The federal government did take some small steps toward encouraging better ventilation. In mid-2023, the CDC put out new recommendations urging 5 air changes an hour, essentially replacing all of the air within a room in all buildings. But it was a recommendation, not a requirement, and local governments and owners of public buildings have been slow to take on the burden of installing or overhauling their ventilation systems. Part of this was surely because of the daunting price tag. In 2020, the Government Accountability Office estimated that approximately 36,000 school buildings had substandard air systems for heating, ventilation, and cooling. The estimated cost for upgrading the systems and ensuring safe air quality in all of the country's schools, some experts calculated, would be about $72 billion. Portable HEPA filters, meanwhile, can be noisy and require space, making them less than ideal long-term solutions. For the most part, momentum for better air indoor quality was dissipated, just as interest in it faded in the 1960s. 5 years after COVID-19 precipitated lockdowns in the U.S., the rate of hospitalizations and mortality from the disease are a fraction of what they once were, and public discussion about ventilation has waned. Truly improving indoor air quality on a societal scale would be a long-term investment, and one that the Trump administration seems very unlikely to take on, given that it is slashing other environmental safety protections. But better ventilation would also limit the cost of diseases other than COVID. Tuberculosis is airborne, and measles is frighteningly good at spreading this way. There is also evidence for airborne dissemination of a range of common pathogens, such as influenza, which in the U.S. led to an estimated 28,000 deaths in the 2023-24 flu season. The same holds true for RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus, which each year causes 58,000 to 80,000 hospitalizations of children under age 5 in the United States and kills as many as 300 of them. Virologists are also now asking whether bird flu could evolve to efficiently transmit through air, too. For those of us still concerned about airborne diseases, it feels as though little has changed. We're right where we were at the start of the pandemic. I remember that moment in the airport and how I later worried about stoking panic, in part because during my flight, I was the only person wearing an N95, one that I had purchased months ago to wear in the dusty crawl space beneath my home. On the plane, I felt like a weirdo. These days, I am, once again, almost always the lone masker when I take public transportation. Sometimes I feel ridiculous, but just the other week, while I was seated on the metro, a woman coughed on my head. At that moment, I was glad to have a mask on, but I would have been even more relieved if the enclosed space of the metro car had been designed to cleanse the air of whatever she might have released and keep it from reaching me. Our second story, The Internet Can Still Be Good, by Adrian LaFrance. In the ever-expanding universe of obsolete sounds, few can compare to the confident yawp of a dial-up modem. Back in the early days, the internet was slow, but we didn't know it yet. Or at least we didn't care. And why should we have? The stuff of the web was organic, something you had to plant and then harvest. It took time. Websites popped up like wildflowers. Far-flung enthusiasts found one another, but gradually. Nobody owned the web, and everybody did. It was open, and everything seemed possible. Everything was possible. Maybe it still is. Strange things are happening online these days. Strange bad, clearly, but also strange good. One unexpected development is that Reddit, long dogged by a reputation for mischief and mayhem, has achieved a kind of mass appeal. If you ask your friends where they've been hanging out online lately, you're likely to hear some of them say Reddit, actually, perhaps with a tinge of surprise. Reddit's founders didn't set out to save the web. College roommates Steve Huffman and Alexis Ohanian wanted to create a mobile food ordering service. But their idea didn't make sense, at least not at the time. It was 2005. The iPhone didn't exist yet. So they built something else, no less ambitious, a site that promised to be, quote, the front page of the internet, end quote. Reddit was a place to share all manner of memes, photographs, questions, embarrassing stories, and ideas. Users could upvote posts into internet virality, or sometimes infamy. Eventually, they built their own communities, known as subreddits. For the first decade of its existence, Reddit was not exactly a respectable place to hang out. Like its spiritual cousin 4chan, Reddit was primarily known for, among other things, creep shots, revenge porn, abject racism, anti-Semitism, and violent misogyny. Endearing corners of Reddit existed, but you couldn't get to them without stumbling over some seriously disturbing material. Some of that disturbing material is still there if you look for it, but lately the gross stuff has been crowded out by the good stuff, and more people have congregated on Reddit. Last year the company went public, saw a huge swell in audience, and became profitable for the first time in its history. And though its runaway growth slowed last quarter, Reddit says it now has more than 100 million daily users and more than 100,000 active communities. The joy of Reddit comes from it being simultaneously niche and expansive, like an infinite world's fair of subcultures, fandoms, support groups, and curiosities. There seems to be a subreddit for everything and everyone. There are mainstream subreddits with popular appeal, such as r/AskScience with 26 million users, r/Technology with 18 million users. But there are also more esoteric forums, such as r/Rentnerzigeigenflügel, excuse my German, the German language subreddit that's devoted to context-free photos of retirees pointing at random things. That group's stated purpose, hier bekommen alt Menschen die Bühne, die sie werden, excuse my German again, here old people get the stage they deserve. There's r/NotABlueberry, where people share images of berries that are not blueberries, which other people often warn them not to eat. Some subreddits exist just to deliver a punchline, like r/lurkers, a community with more than 41,000 members in which no one posts anything at all. Asking someone where they spend time on Reddit opens a window onto their personality that can be surprisingly intimate. Here, I'll go. I love r/whatisit, where users share photos of confusing objects they encounter. r/Honolulu, which is a mix of island news and extremely local references. And r/tipofmytongue, where people ask for help finding or identifying ungoogleable songs, movies, books, or other scraps of cultural memory. Excuse me. There's r/Metropolis, dedicated entirely to Fritz Lang's 1927 film of the same name. And r/mildly vandalized, a place to share milquetoast visual pranks, such as a shelf of World Book encyclopedias rearranged so their spines lined up to say, weird cock. Reddit may be less hateful these days, but it is still juvenile. There is a subreddit where violinists gently correct one another's bow holds, a subreddit for rowers where people compare ERG scores, and a subreddit for people who are honest to God allergic to the cold and trade tips about which antihistamine regimen works best. One subreddit is for people who encounter cookie cutters whose shape they cannot decipher. The responses reliably entail a mix of sincere sleuthing to find the answer and ridiculously creative and crude joke guesses. Not everything on Reddit is merely cute, of course. I have lost count of the number of friends who have mentioned to me that they add the word Reddit to their Google searches, a shortcut to the place where they know they'll find the best information online. Google, once the unsurpassed king of search, has become hostile to its users, surfacing hilariously unhelpful AI responses, including telling people to eat rocks and glue, and making it woefully difficult to retrieve credible information, even when you know exactly what you're looking for. Reddit, by contrast, offers truly specialized knowledge for every need. It provides travel tips to every conceivable destination and practical advice for every imaginable home improvement project. One friend told me about using Reddit to find the right tension for his tennis racket strings and the best embroiderer for custom hockey jersey. Although the wisdom of the crowd is not fact-checked. Reddit's culture tends to be equal parts generous and skeptical, meaning that good, or at least helpful, information often rises to the top. Recently on the r/creepy subreddit, someone posted about having found a tiny skeleton under the floorboards in their house. Am I cursed for eternity now? They wanted to know. The top reply came from someone who explained that they were a zoo archaeologist and could therefore be 95% certain that this is a mouse skeleton, and offered to send their own photo of a mouse skeleton for reference. Hell yeah, someone else chimed in. Ask a random question and get an answer from someone who specializes in the exact niche. Amazing. How did this happen? How did Reddit go from being a disgusting fever swamp to an oasis of happiness, expertise, exuberance? Excising the most egregious subreddits was the first step, and not an uncontroversial one. Good and necessary free speech debates followed. But the site has always given its users more control than other major social platforms. Reddit's moderators are almost exclusively volunteers, and they are power users. They set the rules for the subreddits they run, and they tend to take their job seriously. The subreddit r/askhistorians has a reputation for being one of the most heavily moderated communities on Reddit. Rather than deleting some comments, it seems to delete most of them. If you don't like that, and there are plenty of people who don't, you can join another subreddit for history buffs, or start your own. On Reddit, it's people, not the platform, who decide what any one community should be. Reddit does still ban whole subreddits sometimes, as it did recently with a group posting violent threats. Even the most ridiculous forums make their expectations known. In the subreddit r/divorcedbirds, which is for sharing images of birds that look like serial monogamists, moderators specify the following. Please post pictures of birds who look like they are twice divorced or more, and an original caption about their backstory. Also, no photos of human women, no art, paintings, or Photoshop, and no dead birds. Giving users this much control over a major social platform is basically unheard of anymore. It's a throwback to the early web, when people had to tend to the sites they wanted to be part of. And it's a stark contrast to the way other social media sites have evolved. Reddit is surging at a time when much of the rest of the social web has curdled. The multi-stream platforms are overrun with a combination of bots, bigots, and bad AI. Especially because platforms such as X and Facebook have declared that the substance of what people post is of no concern to them. Which is how they got to the point that Reddit, of all places, has developed a reputation as a force for good, or at least a force for reminding people of the promise of a decentralized open web. The social giants that worship at the altar of megascale, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, X, have chosen to do so at the expense of humanity. They train their algorithms to feed people the things that make them angry and afraid and keep them scrolling. Reddit has its own ambitions for exponential growth, but so far it has managed to retain a small group feeling while still operating at scale. The question is whether this is a sustainable model. What if this golden moment for Reddit is not a renaissance, but a last hurrah? One final reminder of what could have been before a tsunami of AI wipes out the places that once sparkled with humanity. Reddit recently unveiled its own AI product, Reddit Answers, to the disgust of many of its users. And some longtime users worried that something essential will be lost as normies flock to the platform. For now, though, Reddit remains wildly original and startlingly generous, which is to say, deeply and gorgeously human. It provides connection to others, stokes curiosity, and, at least in some of the subreddits, leaves you with a feeling of time well spent, a rarity on other social platforms. Because as different as each Reddit community is, every good subreddit is irrepressibly captivating for the same reason, the people. Recently, someone posted a question on r/AskReddit. What have you done on this platform that you're most proud of? The answers ranged from earnest to irreverent. People described feeling good about having used Reddit to read more and to challenge their understanding of the world. Others praised themselves for not posting mean comments when they had the impulse to. One person described having spent 2 years on a guitar subreddit learning 100 different solos. Another described how they'd posted a cookbook of reverse-engineered Panda Express recipes to the delight of other users, though not apparently to the delight of Panda Express. Somebody else felt proud of having taught fellow Redditors how to open a box filled with packing peanuts without making a mess. One wrote, "I've been helping strangers with their various math questions for over 10 years. Another, "I make people laugh from time to time." What Reddit does, it turns out, is give people a space that they can create and collectively control, where they can ask one another question after question after question in every possible permutation. The place is flooded with expertise and genuine wisdom, and it's filthy with rabbit holes. But the only two questions that people ever really ask on Reddit, if you think about it, are these: am I alone? Am I okay? And after all these years, in subreddit after subreddit, no matter what the topic at hand is, the same answers keep coming. You aren't alone. And you might not be okay. But we're here. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.